1 Peter chapter 4, I'm going to begin reading this morning in verse 12 and read through the end of the chapter. He says, "Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you, as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed. If you are insulted for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. But let none of you suffer as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or as a meddler. Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in that name. For it is time for judgment to begin at the household of God. And if it begins with us, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if the righteous is scarcely saved, what will become of the ungodly and the sinner? Therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good." This is the word of the Lord. Now, very practical. I'm calling this message, "How to Suffer Well." And I'm going to make 5 observations here in this text, and I'm going to put it to you this way. Peter's kind of instructing people who are accustomed to suffering but not knowing how to suffer, that the key to suffering is that you need to learn to shift things away from your normal reactions to suffering to a series of other things. Beginning with number one, he says, shift your expectations. This is very simple, but he basically starts off by saying, beloved, do not be surprised. Okay? How many of you know that when you do not expect life to be hard, you expect it to be a breeze, you think to yourself maybe even, well, now that I trust Christ, now that I've got God in my life, I've got the solution to everything, and it's going to be so much easier. It's going to be a breeze now because I've got God on my side, and whatever I'm trying to do, just, you know, doors will open to me and everything's going to be wonderful. And it's not that way, is it? And there are even preachers and churches out there telling you that this is the way it is, that if you just bring God into your life, or if you just have enough faith, every mountain will move, every door will open, and it's simply not true. Peter begins here by saying, do not be surprised at a fiery trial. And he's using a word that's related to, we know the word pyromaniac, like someone who's crazy about playing with fire. He uses the word pyrosis, which literally is a burning pain. That he's saying, not only are there going to be trials in your life, which we use that word very broadly and very glibly. Oh, I'm going through trials right now. And he's saying, you're not just going to have trials. There are going to be things in your life that feel like a burning, searing sensation. Don't be surprised by it. Okay? He's echoing the words of Jesus, by the way. Jesus in John 15:20 said, "Remember the word that I said to you, if they persecuted me, they will persecute you." And he goes on to say, a servant is not above his master. If the master gets persecuted and you're really walking in my footsteps, you can expect not just suffering in general, but you can expect discrimination. You can expect to be marginalized by a certain segment of the world that doesn't want to hear your perspective or to see the way you live your life. And Jesus is saying, expect it. The Apostle Paul, 2 Timothy 3:12, says, all who desire to live a godly life in Christ Jesus will be persecuted. And all of these, Jesus and Paul and Peter, are saying the same thing. When you expect not to suffer, then what happens when the pain comes, the suffering comes, is you actually add other layers of suffering because you didn't expect it. You didn't plan for it. Those other layers are things like shock and dismay. Like, oh no, what in the world? Do I not have enough faith like these other people? And he's saying, if you would expect it, if you would brace for it, if you would prepare mentally and spiritually for it, it would be easier to handle. Not less painful, but easier to handle. Okay? We go up to Grand Lake every summer, and I now know that the waters of Grand Lake are frigidly cold in the middle of the summer, okay? So when we're getting in to go tubing or go wake surfing or whatever, there is a big mental preparation that I put myself through as I ease myself into the water. And what I tell myself is, this is going to be like literally sliding into the middle of an ice cube, and it's going to be searing pain, but from cold, not from heat. And so anything less than that, you're like, okay, it's cold. It's really cold, but it's not like I'm not dying. And I think when we adjust our expectation, to prepare mentally, spiritually for suffering. That's just kind of this practical pastoral advice that he's giving you. Of if you know it's going to be really cold, if you know it's going to be really hard, you can prepare for this and be thinking ahead and planning ahead. So practically, I want to ask you, what do you think could never happen to you? Do you think you could never get cancer? Do you think you could never lose a child? Do you think you would never experience a divorce? Do you think you would never be in this kind of accident? Do you think you would never be the one who gets cut from your job? And we can make a whole list of things. Do you think you would be the one who would never suffer the kind of persecution that some of these people were facing? Because, and I'm not saying that we sit there and just mentally rehearse, oh, what else could happen to me? What else could happen to me? And have this fear-mongering, but just saying, like, I'm not above any of that. God could use any of that in my life to refine me into the person that he wants to be. Then you're prepared for it. So he says, shift your expectations. Number two, he says, and I'm going to say, shift your basis. And what I mean is shift the basis on which you're suffering in the first place. And you notice where he just, again, very practically, he says, basically, life is full of suffering. Sorry, okay? Just is. Life is full of suffering. So, friend, make sure that you're suffering not because you're killing people or hating them, as Jesus would say, not because you're stealing from them or stealing their reputation, not because you're an evildoer or even meddlesome, which is just like you're going around just putting your nose in everybody else's business. You're a busybody. You got to have the gossip. Well, people end up not liking gossips, okay? And he's saying, make sure that when you suffer, it's not I'm suffering for sin, or hey, it's not technically a sin. Okay, but you're obnoxious, okay? And obnoxious people suffer from other people. And he's saying, shift the basis so that the reason that you're suffering is because of your obedience to and your allegiance to Jesus Christ, not because you're just a jerk. Now, we love to play the victim card as Christians in America. We just do. And I hope that you can see that, that any little thing happens and we're like, ah, persecution, it's terrible. And it's a little bit like going and telling all your friends or, you know, even now we all post on social media. So we take pictures of our car that was just totaled. And we're like, this guy just totally blew into me in the middle of the intersection. Well, there's a difference between I ran a red light and a guy hit me. And I was stopped at the red light and a guy hit me. And I think spiritually, sometimes Christians don't differentiate between those two things. It's just, I got hit. Woe is me. It's persecution. Again, just Peter's pastoral advice is, let's think about our attitudes, our tone. Let's think about maybe the self-righteousness, the superiority with which we carry ourselves. Because simply having a conviction, this is right, you may already suffer because of that. We don't need to layer on top of your conviction that, like, this is right, or this is a biblical definition of this, or God calls me to practice this, and that's not real popular right now. But to do that with a humble spirit, a gracious spirit, rather than a condemning spirit that's always in other people's business, again, he's just being very practical. It's not persecution because someone disagrees with you. I had an acquaintance several years ago who he was always talking about the persecution he was facing in his work. He was being passed over for opportunities to do different things within this organization. And other people that were not nearly as qualified as him were getting these things. And he kept saying, it's because of my testimony. It's because of my testimony. It's because of my testimony. I'm just an outstanding Christian, and my boss just hates Christians and all this stuff. And I finally did with him, like I've done with a number of you, where I visit you in your workplace. And he introduced me to this guy. And in just a moment, I just pulled him aside. And this was just to help my friend. And I had a short conversation with him of like, hey, are there opportunities for this guy, you know, this next semester or quarter or however you do your business to take on some additional stuff? He goes to my church and, you know, I'm a pastor and I'm a friend of his and I'm just looking after him. And I'll never forget the gist of what this guy said. Well, first of all, he said, oh, man, I had no idea he was a believer. And he said, he's not getting passed over for stuff because he's a believer. He said, he's a pompous jerk who's not especially good at his job. Okay? And Peter's saying, and it's right there in the original Greek, he's saying, don't be a pompous jerk who's not good at your job. Okay? Shift the basis of why you're suffering. You know, sometimes we're better served to keep our mouths shut and to work hard for the glory of God and not for self-promotion. And I read this quote this week from a commentary. This guy says, "The Lord disapproves when we violate reasonable social standards. He does not bless tactlessness or folly, even if they're somehow connected to the faith. A worker cannot claim persecution if, while proselytizing a fellow laborer, he talks beyond the lunch hour and is rebuked for it. If we bark out correction whenever our peers speak crudely, we can expect rejection. Leaders have a right to set standards for their organizations, but ordinary employees should keep their judgments private. God does not bless tactless behavior, and it is not persecution when obnoxious acts earn wrath." And some of you probably even feel this as I do. I'm not against someone standing on a street corner sharing Christ. Sometimes I wish I had that kind of boldness. But you've probably all had the experience either being downtown here or in the subways of another major city or outside, you know, the Broncos Stadium or Pepsi Center as a major sporting event or a concert's letting out, and you know that one guy on the bullhorn that's just barking at everyone and yelling. And before you even hear the words from a distance, you know the tone is all off, like he's angry, like he's superior. And you already kind of start to cringe. We had this experience back in May in the subway system of New York, and I was like, I bet he's preaching. And we get closer and closer, and it's just damnation, and you're all gonna burn, and you know, this kind of stuff. And you know, most people were walking by. That's not persecution, because tone and words and attitude matter. And should we be sharing our faith? Absolutely. And Peter talks about that extensively in this same letter, which is a very short letter. How do we share our faith? How do we point people to Jesus? How do we draw them to see how wonderful God really is? But he's saying, think about how you may become meddlesome to other people and actually be pushing them away. So shift the basis of why you're suffering. Number three, he says, shift your reactions. How do you react to suffering? Do you have a standard default of like something's bad is happening in your life? And by the way, I think as I read this, my understanding is when he just begins verse 12, "Do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you." You get to share in Christ's sufferings. I think 12 and 13, he's just talking about general sufferings. He's not talking necessarily about persecution. But as he gets down in this text, you do understand suffering as a Christian, suffering because you identify with Jesus, that he gets into that as well. So there's both a broad, "I'm going through a hard time" kind of suffering that he's talking about, and also that "I'm being rejected," or "I'm being ridiculed," or "I'm being slandered because I identify with Jesus." And do you know, are you self-aware enough to know, hey, when that fiery thing hits me and it hurts, what is my initial knee-jerk reaction typically to suffering? And he lists some here. He talks about like the shock. We already talked about that, of just the shock of like, I can't believe this is happening. And Peter's like, well, believe it's happening, because stuff like this happens. I mean, it's just that simple. We live in a broken world. We are broken. Now, God is in the process of restoring, but we're still broken. We're surrounded by broken people with broken lives, broken relationships. Don't be shocked. But he also says, don't be ashamed. And a lot of times what this is there's a layer of humiliation, there's a layer of insult that gets added, where it's almost like adding insult to injury, where it's like, I've already been hurt, and now some people are coming, and they're shaming me, they're disgracing me because of the thing I'm suffering. This is a little bit like Job's friends, and some of you may even have had that experience, as I have, where you go through something very painful, and people crawl out of the woodwork to say, well, the reason that you're suffering is because you're hiding some unknown sin like Job, or this or that, or God is punishing you. And there's a layer of shame that you react with as well. He doesn't mention this explicitly, but I think complaining is just a very common reaction of just, this is not fair, God. And we go grumble to people of like, you won't believe what I'm experiencing right now in my finances or this relationship or at work, or, you know, it's just a grumbling about people and circumstances, even grumbling about God, which leads to anger, frustration, venting, You know, the longer you hold on to that object of pain, like the more painful and the heavier it gets to you, and it gets harder and harder to let go of, and it just builds this resentment where some of you, someone sitting here this morning, you made me like, it's hard to come to church because honestly, and I put on a good face, but I'm mad at God right now. I'm angry that God allowed this in my life, or that I feel like he did it to me. And I think the last place that this naturally leads us is just the natural reaction of just, I quit. Like, fine, if you're going to be this way, God, I'm done. I'm done with you. I'm done with keeping the rules. I'm done with the faith. People quit. And Peter's here giving this counsel of what would gospel reactions look like instead of the knee-jerk reactions of shock and shame and complaining and anger and, God, I'm done. Look at verse 13 again with me. Don't be surprised, verse 12, but rejoice. Okay, how many of you, that's your natural reaction to fiery trials in your life? My natural reaction is just, thank you, God. And this is not a cynical thanks, God. What's next? He's talking about a genuine rejoicing. And you're like, Peter, like, what is this guy, a masochist? Like, he's rejoicing in pain? Yeah, bring it on. I desire pain. I don't think he's talking about rejoicing at the trial. I don't think, on the other hand, that he's merely talking about rejoicing in spite of the trial. Because we can do that. We can kind of compartmentalize the trial. And be like, that hurts, but I'm, you know, if I pretend that that's not going on, I can rejoice in spite of that. I think the spirit of what he's getting at is that no matter what that fiery thing is, whatever the suffering is in your life, you can rejoice at what God is doing in you, and you can rejoice at what God is doing for you. And he's calling us that when the natural reaction is, hey, I have a grumbling spirit right now. He says, go back to what I said in chapter 1, verse 6. In this you rejoice, though now for a little while you have been grieved by various trials, so that the tested genuineness of your faith may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So he's saying, if you look at the big picture, and I'm going to tap into this in just a moment. If you look at the big picture of, God, I understand something of what you're doing in me and for me, even through, or especially through, the things in my life that hurt, I can praise you. Reaction 2, verse 16, he says, glorify God in that name. And he's talking about the name Christian, okay? And, you know, some of us, we're ashamed to be Christian. We're not ashamed to be Christian. We're ashamed to have that name or that association put on us, not so much because we're ashamed of Jesus himself, but because of what our culture looks at. Oh, that's what Christians do. Oh, of course they're saying that. That's what Christians say. And notice he's saying, turn that shame and just be willing to glorify God. And I think the reason that we have a lot of those reactive tendencies is that, first of all, we go into the trial thinking life's about me. Life is about my comfort, my ease, my promotion, my will, my way, right now, all the time. And then life doesn't go that way. And that's part of why it hurts, is because you had the expectation that you could be in control. And he's saying, what if instead you could say something like this or pray something like this? God, I don't understand what you're doing right now, and I don't even necessarily agree. But I want you to be honored by the way I react. And I know others are watching, and I want their attention to be drawn to them. You know, so this is written by Peter, right? Peter, the guy that when his best friend Jesus is going to trial, Peter's like, 3 times, I don't know him. He swears, cusses, swears, disassociates from him. Later on, Peter's going to be arrested, and he's going to suffer because of his association with Jesus Christ, and he's going to say, I count it an honor. What an incredible thing that I get to be associated with the Jesus who suffered for me. And the one place that he disassociated from Jesus is when he goes to be crucified as Jesus was. He said, I will request that you crucify me upside down because I'm not worthy to be killed in the same manner as my Lord. Okay, so he's like, I want to glorify God even unto death. I want to honor him in my reactions. And that's what he's calling us to. Okay, I'm not there yet of, like, how do we do that, okay? but just hear what he's saying. So rejoice, glorify God. One more thing here, verse 19, and the last phrase that he gives us here is he gives us the idea of, and continue to do good. Okay? Because our tendency in trials is that trials are disruptive to our life. And even if you had patterns of doing right things, right practices, even right like devotional practices, I pray and I spend time in the Word, suffering can be very disruptive of all of that. And you stop doing those healthy spiritual practices. You stop serving others because your focus is on yourself. And by the way, in all the counseling that we do, I mean, one of the worst things you can do when you encounter suffering is, what's your natural tendency? Is to now focus inward. I'm suffering. It hurts. I'm in pain. I'm discouraged. Oh, now I'm depressed. Now I'm over the top depressed. And the longer that you sit in your house with the shutters closed, just thinking about your mess, and this is, again, the wisdom of pastors saying, don't stop doing good. Get out of your house. Go serve someone less fortunate. And let God continue to work through you as you're trying to work it out. What does this suffering mean? What is God going to do with this suffering? So that's what I mean by shifting these reactions from just the natural fleshly, I don't like this, I'm in pain, I'm ashamed, this hurts, I'm mad at God, to God, help me rejoice, help me glorify you, help me to continue to take the next right step in faith, even as I suffer. So one day when I wake up from this bad dream that's a part of my life, I'm actually a few steps closer to you instead of looking back and being like, I realized that was a season of my life when I took off and ran. And now I find myself back here. So that's three. Number four, Peter's encouraging us, shift your perspective. Where does your mind automatically go when you're suffering? What is the perspective that you're looking at? What is the perspective that you're looking through? I think most of us, if you're like me, you tend to focus on the problem. I'm driving down the highway. Now there's an obstacle. What do you tend to look at when there's an obstacle in the road and you're driving down the highway? You look at the obstacle. You focus on the obstacle. When I took a motorcycle training class, it had been years since I'd ridden. I finally decided I was going to buy my own street bike. I'm just going to go make sure I'm being as safe as possible. What happens all the time, people get up in the mountains and they're going around these curves, okay? And all of a sudden, what a novice will do is they're going around this curve and they see a dump truck or a logging truck or something coming the other way. And they're like, oh no, like big truck barreling down on me the other way. And they look at the truck. And guess what happens? They hit the truck. So the training is, look where you want to go. Look around the curve. Yeah, there's that big scary truck right there. But if you look where you want to go, basically you're going to go there. It's kind of the same thing with skiing. I always wonder how people hit trees. Well, it's because they looked at the tree. You know, they got toward the edge of the slope and they were going too fast and they're like, oh no, there's a tree right there, and they just lock onto the tree and bam, they hit the tree. Okay? Now, that's not the only way you hit trees, but that's one of the main ways, is we tend to go toward what we're focused on, what we're gazing at. And so my question is, where do you want your suffering to take you? Okay, so Peter's saying, you're going to suffer. You just are. Where do you want that to take you? Do you want that to take you into a collision where you wreck your spiritual life? Or do you want God to take you deeper? Do you want God to take you to new places in your growth, in your faith, in your understanding of Him? And so listen just again to this practical wisdom that Peter shares. This is his perspective. He says, first of all, remember that Christ suffered for you. That's your A. He's saying, you want a big perspective that's going to help guide you through this to a better place, to spiritual growth, to flourishing. Remember that Christ suffered for you. Verse 13, but rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings. And I want you to notice, he doesn't say, insofar as you share Jesus' sufferings. Now, so what? Well, Jesus is the human name. And we think of Jesus. Yeah, Jesus died on the cross for my sins. And he doesn't say Jesus, although he could have. He says the Christ. So what? Well, the Christ is that word Messiah. Christ is the word anointed one. He's the king. He's God's chosen. And what Peter's calling you to remember is not just, oh, yeah, Jesus died on the cross. He's calling you to remember the Messiah, God's anointed one, the one with all of God's favor, suffered. Why? because he identified with you. See, the very fact that we're called to identify in Jesus' sufferings should jar us every time where we're like, okay, remind myself, why did Christ suffer? He's the King. He's the eternal Son of God. He's sinless. He did nothing wrong. He didn't even have to come to this earth. Why did he suffer? Because he identified with me. Because he identified with you. And now the perspective that Peter's training you is just as Jesus identified with you, just as Christ identified with you to suffer for you in your behalf, now you get the chance in essence to, in the midst of your suffering, you get to return the favor and say, I identify with you. This brings us closer in my understanding of you and what you went through for me. So he says, remember the suffering of Christ. Number two, or B, remember that suffering is a, now listen to this one, remember that suffering in God's will is a sign of God's favor. We don't believe that as Americans because we are privileged, because we have more labor-saving and pain-saving devices than any culture in the history of the world. But listen to verse 14. He says, if you are insulted for the name of Christ, you are blessed, because the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. He's using the same word that Jesus used back in the Beatitudes. Remember that whole list of blessed are these people, blessed are these people, blessed are these people. And at the end of that list, Matthew 5, 10 and 12, Jesus says, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when others revile you and persecute you and utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. And there also he says, rejoice and be glad, for your reward in heaven is great. Blessed. I mean, it's happy, favored. Now, not all suffering is a sign of God's favor. Okay, if I took a screwdriver and I walked over to this outlet right here and I shoved that screwdriver in here, that tingling feeling would not be the presence of God. Okay, it's the glory of God rests upon me. No, he's not. Again, he's differentiating between you're being obnoxious or you're being sinful. But what he is saying is if you're walking with the Lord, and we all do so imperfectly, but if you're walking with the Lord and you're suffering in his under his hand, under his care, that is not a sign of God's punishment. That's not a sign that God is against you. That's not a sign that you need to wake up and learn that mystery lesson that you're like, just tell me, God, what's the thing I'm supposed to learn so I can check the box and we move on past the suffering. He's saying this is an evidence of God's favor. Because in the midst of that suffering, it's like the, you know, those three Hebrew boys in Daniel, where they're like, we're not going to bow down to your idol, king. Well, if you don't bow down to the idol, I'm throwing you in the furnace. Well, we're not going to bow down. And God can do what he wants to do, but we're not going to bow down. And he's literally throwing them into the fiery trial, okay? What happens? Jesus shows up in the fire with them, right? So they experience the presence of God in a unique and powerful way, because they were willing to suffer with him. And I'm not saying that he's promising you exactly that. That seemed like kind of like a one-time thing for Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. But that is illustrative of the kind of things that God is promising to do. That when you identify with Christ and choose to suffer while doing good, it is a sign of God's favor in your life, because he's able to enter that with you. He's able to stay with you through that, okay? So that's the second part of this perspective. Third part, this is kind of interesting. We wouldn't think of this one, I don't think. But he says, remember that those who cause your suffering may not share your salvation. This is the point of verses 17 and 18. Cryptic again to us. Peter writes weird, right? As we translate from the Greek to the English. But he says here, it is time for judgment to begin at the household of God. And if it begins with us, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And if the righteous scarcely are saved, what will become of the ungodly and the sinner? And again, we may hear this as like, wow, it sounds like he's threatening Christians. Like, get your act together, because I'm going to start judging you guys in the church even before I judge the world. And this whole scarcely saved thing sounds like some of us are going to get into heaven by the skin of our teeth, right? Like God standing there like, okay, you got in, but you got smoke on you. And I want you to understand that the gospel makes it very clear, nobody gets into heaven by the skin of their teeth. You get into heaven by the flesh and blood of Christ, okay? So you're not, that's not what he's saying. So I actually think, I'm going to disagree. I love the ESV, okay? This is the word of God. I will disagree with the translators on the word scarcely. It's a word that means with great difficulty. He's not saying you will barely make it in. You scarcely made it, but you made it. He's saying you'll make it in. You will spend forever with God, but it will come through difficulty. And it's very important. He's paraphrasing Proverbs 11:31, if the righteous is repaid on earth, how much more the wicked and the sinner? And his point is not that the Jesus follower barely gets in by the skin of his teeth. His point is you're only saved, finally, after experiencing suffering, going through opposition. And he's saying, Christian, it is better to be repaid on earth with the world's judgment and the forever acceptance of God than to live like the world and get the world's acceptance, but to live forever with the judgment of God. Okay? And by the way, he's saying this judgment of God has already begun because, you know, Jesus himself told about the sheep and the goats, and he's making a separation. The word judge just simply means to discern, to make a separation. And he's saying, as you're willing to suffer bearing the name of Christ, and again, it may be suffering directly related to because I identify with Christ, and it may be while I'm identifying with Christ, I'm struggling, I'm suffering. But he says, your willingness to continue to identify with Christ is already a sign of God's separation, showing you, hey, you've got the Spirit of God doing something in your life to hold you fast. Okay? How does that change your perspective? Looking back at this big principle I just gave, the perspective that some of the very people who are causing your suffering do not share your salvation. See, because we're like everybody else, right? You get in that trial, and if you know it's a coworker or it's an un-Christian family member or whatever that's causing you that pain, it is very easy to just act in the flesh and be like, I'm going to get that person back, or I'm going to distance. I'm going to just ignore that person. I'm not even going to try. And he's saying, but what if you knew that person right now sits under the judgment of God? Like, they're not right with God. And if things are difficult for you, how much harder are they going to be for someone who's like, I don't accept God's remedy of Jesus? Would it change your perspective at all to know that person doesn't just need for me to get back at them? That person needs Jesus. Or they don't have hope that I have. So there's a bigger picture here than me getting even or me getting even mad and upset and all worked up about it. How, Lord, can I turn this suffering into an opportunity to maybe lead that person toward repentance and faith in Jesus by the way I react to what they're doing to me? That's unfair. I shouldn't have to suffer. That's the person that's doing, well, yeah, but that's not fair either. I mean, that's the whole picture of the cross is Jesus takes everything unfair so that we get positively everything that's unfair, okay? Now, I got one more point here because I realize up to this point in the sermon, it just sounds like advice, right? And advice scares me because somebody could leave here this morning and be like, okay, sounds like he's got a checklist here, like expect suffering, check. Suffer for right rather than wrong. Okay, check. Rejoice rather than complain. Glorify God. Don't just focus on myself. Okay, check. Be merciful toward the non-believers because they need something, namely Jesus. Check. Okay, there. Am I good? Okay, title of the sermon, you know, have I learned to suffer well now? Check, 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 check. No. Because it's not a checklist. Point five. He's going to ultimately say here in this text, you want to suffer well, then shift your hope. Shift your hope. I got three things here very briefly. Number one, you got the hope of permanence, I call it, the hope of permanence. And that is, God is giving you a glorious future. And whatever you're working through now, Paul's going to refer to it as a momentary light affliction that is preparing you for an exceeding weight of glory forever. And I've been through stuff, like many of you probably, that I'm like, this is light? This is momentary? I mean, no, we're on year 3. It's not momentary. I think a momentary is like I blink my eyes, right? And we want trials to be like I blinked and I woke up from the bad dream. And it doesn't work that way, does it? Paul's point, as Peter's point, is there's something so incredible coming that a lifetime of suffering with Christ and for Christ will feel like it was momentary, it was just a blip. And we're like, that was it in light of this forever? I'm talking with a couple friends in the church right now about, possibly, I just realized as I started this illustration, I haven't told my wife about this yet. So, Marty, so a couple of us are talking about like possibly climbing Long's Peak at the end of the summer. And I did this a decade ago. And it's like 15 miles, and it's a brutal climb. But you do one of these climbs, and it's just plodding along. I mean, we start at like 2 a.m., and your first 4 hours of hiking are with a headlamp looking at one little spot on the ground, okay? And you're just next foot in front of the other, and you're exhausted, and you just go and go and go. And then the alpenglow comes up on the diamond, and you're like, all right, that's pretty cool. And you kind of turn around, and you're already way above the tree line, and you're actually near the summit at sunrise. I mean, and it's just incredible, glorious views. And then the whole illustration falls apart because you got to come back down. What Peter's saying is you don't have to come back down. The labor to walk with Christ in faith through the midst of your suffering, and it hurts, and it's exhausting, and it's filled with fears and contradictions and all these things. But look at 13 again. He says, rejoice insofar as you share Christ's sufferings, that's half of it, that you may also rejoice and be glad when his glory is revealed forever. Realize that our ultimate hope of the gospel is not just, well, at least God's making you a better person. Now, my ultimate hope is God's taking me somewhere with this suffering that is going to be so glorious, so beautiful, so filled with human flourishing and healing that we'll look back and say, that was totally worth it. Okay? That's point one. That's the first hope, the hope of permanence. God's giving you a glorious future. Now, these next two go together, the hope of purpose, the hope of purpose. You know the difference between purposeful and purposeless suffering? Purposeful suffering. I have a baby inside me. I don't have a baby inside me. A woman would be saying, I have a baby inside me. This baby has to come out. Purposeful suffering. But I've had dear friends that before that delivery, I mean, with a full-term child, found out your baby's stillborn in the womb. You still have to go through the delivery. Okay? Purposeful versus what feels like purposeless, right? I still got to go through the pain, but what do I get? I get a body to bury. Feels totally different, right? Or, this is a form of torture of like, hey, take that pile of dirt and move it over there. Now move it back. Now move it back. Now move it back. That's different than like digging out for the foundation of your dream house, right? Purposeful versus purposeless. And I hear Peter saying very clearly in this text, verse 12, every suffering that you can experience as a follower of Jesus is purposeful. Okay? He says, beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you. Why did the trial come upon you? Not to crush you, not to discourage you, not to dishearten you, not to undermine your faith, not to tempt you to sin. He says, to test you. It's the word examine. It's to reveal the true nature of something. And they have a scratch test with different, like diamonds, for example. Someone gives you a rock, and they say, this is a diamond. It's worth $10 million. And there are different tests you could do with that diamond where you're scratching other hard materials. Okay, it's scratched glass. Okay, it may still be in the running, or it may be cubic zirconium. We scratch something that's harder. We scratch something that's harder. We get to something that finally is going to either disavow the fact that that's a diamond, or it will prove out that it's a diamond. And part of what Peter's saying is, this is never a purposeless, ha, 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 I gotcha, punishment. Yeah, I'm mad at you. Kind of test from God. That it's always a revelation of what you're made of. It's important that God give you tests. You know, I did not like tests growing up and going through school. And I know different teachers have different philosophies of testing, and some of you are teachers. I think the right reason for tests is the student needs to know, how much do I really grasp this? Before I go operate on a real live human, how much do I really understand how this particular surgery works, right? And you want to know that you know before you're moving on. So it's encouraging to me that there's this hope of purpose, that God is using our trials to show us what we're made of, to show us where we have areas of weakness, areas of doubt, areas of brokenness that he still wants to heal. But there's a more important point here that I want to close on. Do you understand that God is ultimately not using tests to show you what you're made of, but he's using the test to show you what he's made of? Verse 19, he says, therefore. So in other words, here's my conclusion to my talk on suffering, friends. Therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful creator while doing good. See, when we're going through life, just everyday life, you won't admit this, but your functional hope is the myth that good people don't go through bad stuff. That is your hope. That's my hope. If I keep obeying the rules, keep trusting God, keep walking with the Lord, I can avoid most of this stuff. That's a myth, okay? Then when things do go sideways, I think for most of us, as followers of Jesus, our hope shifts to, but God, I trust you, I love you, I hope in you, and we're hoping in ourselves. That's how we pray. God, remember my obedience. I believe in you, so get me out of this thing. Change this in my life. Make it go away. And I want you to hear me out because I think this is the crux of the entire text. What if your ultimate hope was not your faithfulness to God, but God's faithfulness to you? What if that was your ultimate hope when you encountered brokenness and suffering? You see how he even begins this section? Verse 12, beloved. He wants you to know before he talks about suffering, this suffering is not a sign that God has checked out on you or does not care or is punishing you. He begins by saying, you are loved by a faithful God. Do you know a love that will never let you go, regardless of your ups and downs with obedience, performance, even like, hey, I've got some questions, I've got some doubts, is that okay? What were the last words of Jesus when he suffered on the cross? He said, Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit. The last words of Jesus, Christ, as he suffered were, I entrust myself to you, Father. I entrust myself to you. I don't entrust myself to me. I don't entrust myself to the fact that I had a perfect record. I entrust myself to you. How much more do those need to be our words in suffering? Father, into your hands I commit my spirit, my life, my hope. This hope that we have a faithful creator who's not going to stop recreating us until we are fully fashioned in his image and his glory and his likeness and we're home forever. Now, I know most of you would say, I believe in this God. I believe that this is true. But how many of you trust him? How many of you entrust yourself to him? There is a giant leap between belief, like, yes, I mentally acknowledge that what that text says is true. God is trustworthy in my trial. There's a massive leap between that and what the word entrust means is to commit yourself entirely to the care of. That's what Jesus was doing on the cross. When he said, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit. He's saying, Father, I entrust. I commit my entire life into the care of you. 1859, there was a famous Frenchman, tightrope walker, Charles Blondin, brought his act over to the United States, and he would string up a 3-inch wire over the top of Niagara Falls, 1,100 feet long, 160 feet above the water. And he would walk back and forth, and crowds would gather from both sides, the Canadian side, the American side, and just watch and be, wow, that's incredible. And he's like, well, this is getting boring. I can do this all day in my sleep. So he's like, let's do it blindfolded. Okay, wow, he does it blindfolded. That's awesome. That's amazing. Okay, let me do it blindfolded with a wheelbarrow. Okay, wow, it's incredible. Let me do it blindfolded, and I'm going to take a stool out there like this, and he'd balance one of the four legs on the rope and then stand on top of the chair. Incredible. Finally, Charles Blondin says, okay, how many of you believe that I could walk across the tightrope with you on my back. And everybody's like, yeah, absolutely believe you could do that. It's awesome. And he's like, okay, so who will volunteer? Nobody. Okay. Because there's a difference between believe, I believe you can do that, and I entrust myself to you. So his manager, Harry Colcord, steps forward because his manager realizes, like, I got to put my money where my mouth is. I'm doing well by this guy. He says, okay, Charles, I will ride across on your back. And there's actually a photograph of him doing this. So he climbs on his back. And what happens is they get out over there, and Harry's hearing the roar of the water, and he's looking down, and he's terrified. And the rope is swaying, and there's a ripple in the wave, and it's going back and forth. And Harry's on the back, and when he feels things start to go this way, Harry's shifting his weight, and Harry's moving, and Harry's doing this, and finally, Blondin says, stop. Only cling to me. If you want to live, do nothing but cling to me. And that's exactly what I hear Peter saying to first century Christians and to us in the midst of our suffering. Stop squirming. Cling to your faithful Creator, and you will live. And you will experience His glory forever.